So the main thing I want to talk about today is causal inequalities. This is work by causal inequalities. And this is work by Reshkov, Costa, and Bruckner. Is this board working now? Oh, are we just stuck on?
Oh, yeah, they don't work.
Okay, so we're only stuck on these ones. Okay. Good to know. This is from, what year was this? 2000 and... No, that can't be right. 2011. So the point of this is to think about when you have indefinite causal structure. This would be a situation where you can't explain what's happening as if there was some underlying definite causal ordering of events. And the idea they had was to do something similar to Bell's inequalities. So in case of Bell's inequalities, you write down a set of inequalities that are good, that if everything is described locally, and then quantum theory violates them, which demonstrates that quantum theory is in some sense non-local. So the idea is to do something similar for causal order. So write down some inequalities which have to be satisfied if you have causal ordering, if you have the underlying definite causal ordering, and then show that that these inequalities are violated in some sense. Now, they're not violated by standard quantum theory, but they are violated by some more general notion of quantum theory that they define. So here's the setup. Imagine we have two local laboratories. One has Alice in it. And there's a quantum bit going in, and a quantum bit going out. And then also, Alice receives a random bit, alpha. Alpha is equal to 0 or 1. She has to output a bit. And likewise, Bob is in a laboratory. And he has a qubit coming in, a qubit going out. He has slightly different. He has a random bit beta and another random bit beta prime coming into the laboratory. And he has to output a bit of information, why. So things are set up so that you can imagine either this qubit going into Alice's lab, in which case some information would be going from Bob to Alice, or this qubit going into Bob's lab, in which case information would be going from Alice to Bob. We want to have these two people play a game, and the objective of the game is to maximize a certain success rate. So the game is like this. So the game, the objective of the game, well, the game, what they do is controlled by beta prime. So if theta prime equals zero, then Bob has the task of communicating the value of beta to Alice, which she should then output as x. And if beta prime equals 1, then it's the way around. If beta prime equals 1, then Alice has the task of communicating alpha to Bob, which he should output as y. So this is a funny challenge because the bit beta prime is random, so they don't know what it's going to be. If beta prime is 0, then Bob is supposed to communicate something to Alice, and if beta prime is 1, Alice is supposed to communicate something to Bob. Now, since the way things are set up, you can either have Alice in front of Bob or Bob in front of Alice temporarily. And so it seems that there's a limit to how well they can do. We can express that limit by writing down this inequality. Well, first of all, define the probability of success for this game. We write it down as half probability x equals beta, given that beta prime equals 0, plus probability that y equals alpha. So we're assuming that beta prime is random, so half the time we'll have beta prime equals 0, half the time beta prime equals 1. So the average probability of success will just be the weighting of those two, weighted with a half, the average of those two. So we want to maximize this. If you think about it, this seems like a reasonable upper bound. So the reasoning is the following. If beta equals 0, Bob is in front of Alice, so Bob is temporarily ahead of Alice, that's like, if beta equals 0, and the situation, the causal situation is this. So Bob is behind, Alice is in front. And if beta equals 0, beta prime equals 0, then Bob can just communicate his bit to Alice, and so he'll get a 1. On the other hand, if it's the way around, then the best, sorry, I'm getting mixed up here. Yeah, that's right. So in this case, if beta prime equals 0, that considered the case where Bob is temporarily behind Alice, then he can just communicate his bit to Alice, and so they can do that with 100% probability. On the other hand, if the causal situation is this way around, then the maximum, the best thing they can do is that Alice can just guess, because Bob can't send his qubit to her till later anyway. So then the best they can do is get 50-50. Okay. So here we have 1 plus half. So on average there, the success rate is 3 over 4. And if you consider beta prime equals 1, then you get the same thing. So just considering it from that sort of simple point of view, you can see that the best they can do is get this equal to 3/4. And you can do a more careful analysis and show that this inequality holds for any strategy that they would adopt. Any questions on that? Okay. So that's the cause of inequality. So now we want to show that this can be violated within some sort of reasonable extension of quantum theory. So here's how that goes. Let's start over here. Probability that they get x and y given certain these certain values for these random bits coming in can be written down like this. So here I'm using the operator tensor notation that I introduced last time. It's different from the notation that they use in their paper, although there's a dictionary between the two types of notation. So what we have here are these operator tensors. So these are operators acting on a Hilbert space that's given by the subscripts and superscripts. And every time we have a repeated index like here, we take the partial trace. So in this case, every single index is repeated. And so we take the trace, take the partial trace over all parts of the Hilbert space, which means we end up with a real number, which is equal to the probability. The diagram corresponding to this is this one. We have Alice's laboratory, Bob's laboratory, and then something in the middle, this thing which connects them. This is the so this thing is going to be called a process matrix. So the next idea is that what they want to do in this paper is they want to impose that the physics in each of these local laboratories is governed by quantum theory as we know it. So the physics here that Alice sees is completely governed by quantum theory, and likewise for Bob. And the thing that may deviate from standard quantum theory is what happens elsewhere. Okay. Thank you. So they impose. So what this means is that the operators associated with what's happening inside these boxes have to satisfy the requirements from quantum theory. So those requirements are that if you take the partial transpose of these operators, then they're a positive. So I talked about these last times. I talked about this constraint last time I spoke. But this constraint comes from demanding that probabilities are greater than or equal to zero. If I get time at the end of the talk, I'll derive these constraints. You have the same constraint on the Bob side. So this T indicates taking the partial transpose. Then we also have the constraint that if we take the sum like this, so here what we're doing is we're taking the partial trace of this operator with the identity, then this has to be less than or equal to the identity on the input. This is equivalent to the constraint that if I have this and I just put a block here, the identity is just where you ignore the outcome at the end. That's that gives me smaller than or equal probabilities than what I get if I just put the block here on the input. Okay. And what this constraint does is it ensures that your probabilities don't get to be bigger than one. So this makes this one makes the probabilities positive, and this stops them being too big. There's a similar constraint for the B side. We have these four constraints that have to be true so that we have quantum theory locally in each of these boxes. And then they impose one more constraint, which is that this is true. So this constraint has to be true in order that that the probabilities that you calculate by expressions like this are non-negative. Any questions? questions on this? Okay. So matrices W that are consistent with this are called process matrices. And the idea is going to be to find a process matrix here which is capable of leading to a violation of this inequality. Does this? Well, this doesn't work either. Okay. Is that the reason that the other the QFT course is in the laboratory? Yeah. Okay. Right, so commit all this to memory. So it's interesting to look at some special cases of process matrix. So special things that we already know about just from standard quantum theory that we can put inside this space just to try to understand what kind of things we could do. So one thing we could do is this process matrix. Could be equal to an entangled state here on the input, that's C, and just the identity measurement on the output. If you do that, then W is equal to some entangled state here associated with that times the identity. Another thing you could do is make this equal to make it equal to some preparation followed by, okay, I'm going to draw a funny shaped box. This is just to indicate that this what happens before this, you have what happens here earlier and here's what happens later. I have an input here and an output here for the F, and then here I have the identity. So what this is a preparation going into Bob's channel, then some channel that takes Bob's input and takes it over here to Alice, to send a state to Alice, and then followed by the identity measurement. So in that case, it's equal to, well, just draw it from here. Okay, so this is the special case where this process matrix is a channel. And then a more general thing you can do is make it so this process matrix is equal to a channel with memory. So it looks like this. We have some state being prepared going into Bob's. Where Bob is, then we have a channel connecting Bob's output to Alice's input. So this is the same as before. We have the identity. But then here we also give Bob a side channel. This is the memory. So that he can communicate also via this entangled state here into this channel. And so this is a more general situation than either of these. In some sense, it's the combination of the two of them. And in this case, the W matrix. Is given by you know, the identity matrix corresponding to here, the identity output here, and then the that should be two, and then just some other matrix everywhere else. And it turns out this is the most general thing you can do if Bob is temporarily before Alice. Okay. The most general thing you can do is have a channel with a side channel here. This is called a channel with memory. This is the memory. Furthermore, any process matrix that can be written like this can be realized as a channel with memory. Okay. And so because this is the most general thing, we can write it as, we can think of it as, well, we can write down some notation for this. We'll notate it like this. So this means that Alice is not before Bob. Okay. Right around. Yeah. So Alice is after Bob, or she may be at the same time as him, because a special case of this channel is this case, where it's entanglement being shared, in which case Alice and Bob can be regarded as having the same time. So yeah, so this is the case where Alice is not before Bob. Right. Now, one thing you can imagine doing is you could be in a situation where Alice and Bob don't know the causal order between them. So it could be that Alice is first, or it could be that Bob is first, and they just don't happen to know who is first. And you know that could happen if they each have faulty clocks, for example. So reading on the clock doesn't tell them who's first and who's second. Well, if that's the case, then you can write down their process matrix as a convex mixture of one like this and a corresponding one where Bob is not before Alice. Down here. And this is the most general situation like that, where either you know, where it's a sort of classical mixture of Bob being before Alice or Alice being before Bob. And so they called this causally separable. So process matrices like this are causally separable. This is kind of like, this is fun because now we have a definition for these causal matrices of sort of separability. You know, just like we have separability in the case of entanglement theory, here we have separability in the case of causal order. And it's clear that causally separable matrices are going to satisfy the causal inequalities that I wrote down earlier. Is there just a, yeah, please.
Why are we always measuring on the identity? Why is that fixed to be the identity?
At the end. Yeah, it's to do with, well, the conditions I wrote down demand conservation of probability. Sorry, demand that the probabilities add up to one. Uh-huh. You know, because you want to calculate some probability at the end, a total probability, and so it turns out that these conditions they write down are violated if you have something that's not the identity on the output, I'm not in a so to give you. I mean, yeah, I'd have to go through the paper and show you how that works out.
Oh, yeah.
But certain processes turn out to be violated. So processes where you post select violate the conditions they write down. Also, causal loops violate the processes they write down, and so on. Certain things don't fit. Any more questions? Okay. So, okay, so this is a causally separable case. So the question is, can you write down a process matrix that's consistent with the constraints on process matrices, but it's not causally separable. So let me do that. I'll use this remaining space here. All right. Okay. Okay. I may resort to that. I've got this space at the moment, which is useful. Okay, so this is the the matrix they write down, which has the property that it's not causally separable. I made a mistake in my when I wrote this down in my notations. I'm having to transcribe it as I go along. So they use Pauli matrices. Okay. So this is the process matrix. It's consistent with the constraints on process matrices. And so the way the protocol is going to work is the following. If let me resort to this board. So we have Alice and Bob. Alice receives alpha, and she has to output x. Bob receives beta and also beta prime, and he has to process out, so output y. Now the and then they have this process matrix in between. like this. Now, if Bob receives beta prime equals 1, then he should measure in the Z basis what this is going to do is it's going to kill this term here, which has an x. Then if you take the take his measurement, which is in a z basis, and project, it's gonna kill this term. So you'll only have this term and this term left over. So you can see this term here. These are meant to be z. Maybe that's not as clear with my handwriting. So then his outcome is going to be correlated with X having, with Alice having something pointing in the Z direction, but there's going to be some noise added in as well. If you do the calculation, then you see that for this case, Alice has a probability equal to 2 plus square root of 2 over 4 of seeing, so she also makes a Z measurement. She has a probability equal to this of getting Z plus. So she outputs her the outcome of her measurement here. And so she has a probability of 2 plus square root of 2 over 4 of being successful at this game. If Bob gets beta prime equals 0, then he measures instead in the x basis. You can do the calculation and you get the same probability of success. So if you take the average of those two numbers, you get the same number. So the probability of success equals 3 over 4. So this particular state violates the causal inequalities. And it shows that there's some there's some sense in which you can define a sort of quantum type theory where you have causally non-separable processes. Now, standard quantum theory doesn't allow this, but nevertheless, it looks like the theory is rich enough to allow this kind of thing. Any more questions on this?
Can you point me at the exact point where standard quantum theory goes, no, this is not allowed, this W that you wrote down?
Right, yeah, so... So in standard quantum theory, you need to impose additional constraints on this W. So you can see in the case of the process A and B, I impose two kinds of constraints. One constraint that made sure the probabilities were greater than or equal to 0. Another one that made sure they were less than or equal to 1. These constraints also, they contain causality as well, because they're taking a unique deterministic effect, which is the identity. So they're saying there's a unique way of ignoring the future. So that's encoded into these constraints. Oh, I actually realized that I made a mistake here. This should just be equal, because I summing over all possible outcomes, so these add up to the identity. In standard quantum theory, this constraint is just like these constraints, but in standard quantum theory, there's a constraint that's similar to these ones too. It's a bit more complicated because of the shape of this process. You can see that this process, I can pull these wires out and make it into make it look like just something that has wires going in and wires going out. And in that case, it would clearly have to satisfy, in standard quantum theory, both these kinds of constraints and also these kinds of constraints. There's actually additional constraints on this object as well. But see, they're able to get away with not imposing these constraints because they only insist that quantum theory is true locally. And then they consider this restricted situation. You do get problems if you allow these process matrices to be used in more general contexts. Like, for example, if you try to take the tensor product of two process matrices, then you get into trouble.
If you don't impose the extra stuff, then.
If you don't impose the extra stuff, So that's a problem with this, and it's not entirely clear if this is really going to work for safe like quantum gravity. But that's where it's coming from. Any more questions? But for me, the biggest problem with this approach is that it sort of does indefinite causal structure in the wrong place. If we want to introduce indefinite causal structure because of quantum gravity, then you would imagine that this was something that would happen locally, almost at a microscopic level. Sort of Planck scale, you'd have a lot of local indefinite causal structure, and then perhaps you wouldn't see it as you zoomed out so much. So that would mean that the right way to go would be instead of having definite causal order locally and then letting it lapse globally, you'd want to impose it just locally. You'd want to say even locally, things that relate to definite causal structure here are not allowed. So something like the input and output structure would have to be abandoned. So my opinion is that the right way to go is not in this process matrix framework, but instead in a framework that gets rid of definite causal structure even locally. But so far there's not really a good quantum framework that does that. The sort of GPT framework that does that, but not a good quantum framework. So I have a few minutes left, and I think what I'll do is I'll wrap up by trying to explain where these conditions come from. But they're not difficult conditions. So I told you that. So if we have an operator tensor like this, it has to satisfy two conditions.
One is that if we take the transpose over the input space, let me write it like this. Minus means input. If we take the partial transpose over the minus over the input part of the space,
we get a positive operator.
And this relates to probabilities being greater than or equal to zero. And then the other condition is if we take the identity,
this is the throwaway operation where we just ignore the output.
Then this should be
less than or equal to the identity over the input. And this condition guarantees that your probabilities are not greater than one. Okay. So where did these two conditions come from? So for this one, any circuit that contains B can be written like this. Because, you know, any circuit, you can always draw a sort of foliation line across it and then put all the operators that appear before into this thing and all the operators that appear afterwards into this thing at the top.
So you can write any circuit like that.
And so now we know, and we know that these things have to be greater than or equal to zero. This is now a probability. It has to be positive.
So what we're left with is this thing here.
I don't need the numbers. So what we have here is this operator here, and we know that if we act on this operator with this one, we have to get a positive number. So it seems like this operator has to be positive in some sense. Every time we act on this operator with this thing, we must get a positive number. Now, remember, the usual definition of positivity is we say an operator D is positive if whenever you act on it of any density matrix, you get a positive number. If this is true for all pure states, then this operator D is positive. That's the usual definition of positivity. And this condition here is almost like that. It's saying that whenever you take the trace of this operator with this thing, then you get a positive number. The only thing that's different is that in this case, everything is, this is a state, so it's all the arrows are pointing up, whereas in this case, you've got one arrow pointing up and one arrow pointing down. I'm not going to go through the details, but that ends up translating into a partial transpose. So in order to write the condition down, you have to actually insert a partial transpose. So that's the reason you have a partial transpose here. Sort of it just inverts the direction, one of those arrows. So that gives you the positivity. And then the other condition,
well,
any circuit containing any circuit containing B written like this, like I said before, except that what you can do is you can just sum over all the different things you might have in the future. So we know whatever this is equal to, whatever probability this is equal to, is less than the probability if we ignore all the things that might happen in the future. In other words, if we just replace that with the identity. So it's sufficient to show that this thing has to be less than or equal to 1. Okay. Well, this is equal to that, because the identity factorizes. You can think about that. You can always write the identity. You can write the identity down as a sum of projection operators onto any basis. So you could choose a basis that is a product basis, and then it factorizes. And now we can see well, this. We can always think of A itself as being a product state. In which case, this thing just vanishes. It just gives us a 1. We think of A as being a normalized product state. And now we just have that this thing has to be true for all possible A's. Now, the only way for this to be true for all possible A's is if... is if this thing is less than or equal to the identity. Okay, so that tells you how the second kind of constraint comes from having probabilities that are not greater than or equal to 1. And also in this derivation, we're using the existence of a unique deterministic effect. So causality is tied into this particular constraint. Okay, well, that's giving you some insight into this sort of world of research to do with causal inequalities and so on. It's become quite a big field of research. So the people who wrote this causal inequalities paper are based in, were based in Vienna. And there's been a lot of research since that original paper. Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you.